Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next couple of half-hour segments, we're going to be visiting a subject that has received a lot of coverage and yet has never really been gotten to the bottom of, to use bad English, ending with a preposition. But what the heck these days, that'll qualify me for a Ph.D., particularly in Kansas, where they're apparently going back to the 14th century with as much speed as they can. We're going to be talking about not only Waco, but we're going to be talking about Waco against the background of the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate affairs. And in particular, we're going to be talking about the Georges Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, and W., the son of a Bush, as I call him, and how Waco is once again coming into play in terms of national politics. We're going to begin by taking a look at one of the aspects of the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate affairs that has largely escaped notice, and this is something which might seem quite distant from Waco at first, but in fact, the people in charge of Waco were people associated with the interagency governmental networks that were created pursuant to National Security Directive 138. And that basically grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. That Vice President was former CIA Director George Bush. And the networks that grew out of the recommendations that followed the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism created the networks that were used by George Bush as his own private spy network and which were the main players in the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate affairs. I mentioned this in the context of Waco because Waco happened about a month. The siege there began about a month into Bill Clinton's administration. I certainly don't think anybody is to be completely exonerated, but the fact of the matter is it was really the Bush team that was in charge of Waco, and it was Bush Justice Department people associated with these interagency governmental networks that were pulling the strings. Those interagency governmental networks still have a lot of people in the Department of Justice, including a fellow we're going to talk about named Mark Richard. But so those of you who are wondering why we're talking about this in the context of Waco, well, stick around, and we're going to be tying that directly in a little bit later. In order to understand the reality of the Iran-Contra affair, one must understand this private spy agency that was run by George Herbert Walker Bush and that grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. And bear in mind that that Vice President, of course, was formerly Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and that is a very formidable jumping-off place for electoral politics in the United States. One of the best descriptions of these networks that grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism is contained in one of the most important books written in recent decades, and a book which is most unfortunately titled The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. That landmark work was co-authored by John Loftus, a former career military officer and Justice Department investigator with a high security clearance, and Mark Ahrens, last name A-A-R-O-N-S. The book was published in hardcover and softcover by the St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994, and the ISBN number is 0-312-11057-X. And I mentioned that the title of this book is unfortunate because there's never been a single volume with as much of the material that I talk about on this program between the covers as this particular book, but the title has led a lot of people to shy away from it. They say, oh, I don't like Jews. I don't want to read about Jews. What it's really about is about the intelligence community, the petroleum industry, power politics, and fascism. And it begins right at the end of World War I and goes right on up through the Persian Gulf War and the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 and a lot of other things that are relatively current. There's a good description in The Secret War Against the Jews of what basically became George Bush's own personal private spy agency. And again, this grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism and was one of the most important elements of American and world power politics in the 1980s and has not received the attention due it. Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley professor, is one of the relatively few people to pay attention to this aspect of Iran-Contra, and it is absolutely pivotal. Although the CIA was involved, certainly, and the National Security Council was involved, certainly, and Oliver North was involved, certainly, they were not the main players. And George Bush, who claimed to be out of the loop, was basically the loop. he was the godfather of these operations, and the illegalities involved in Iran-Contra, from the cocaine trafficking to major violations of international law, and then on over to the Iraq-8 scandal, the arming of Saddam Hussein, including the equipping him with CBW capability, now haunting our GIs in terms of Gulf War syndrome, or in the form of Gulf War syndrome. The criminality and the wrongdoing involved in the Iran-Contra and Iraq-8 affairs continues to take lives in this and other countries and haunts this country as perhaps the single greatest nexus of illegality, even perhaps including the Kennedy assassination, although that certainly was a pivotal event. Loftus and Ahrens in The Secret War Against the Jews described the genesis of these interagency governmental networks that became George Bush's private intelligence service and which were the main vehicles for Iran-Contra and Iraq-8 and, as we'll see, the Waco fiasco. And the Loftus and Ahrens described this as follows. One of the first things President Reagan did in 1981 was to dismantle Carter's National Security Council structure and install his own highly compartmentalized staff organization. The NSC was relegated to a harmless study group, while policy was made in a bewildering maze of separate and secret cells. One top-secret National Security Decision Directive, NSDD No. 3, established a new intelligence organization for Vice President George Bush. The former CIA director now had become the head of his own separate spy agency in the White House. And then there is a quote here. The Special Situations Group, SSG, chaired by the Vice President, is charged, inter alia, with formulating plans in anticipation of crises. In order to facilitate this crisis pre-planning responsibility, a Standing Crisis Pre-Planning Group, or CPPG, is hereby established and will, for each potential crisis, ensure that an interagency group is established and developing contingency plans. Provide guidance to the group and task it with the preparation of preemptive policy options to prevent a crisis if possible, as well as the preparation of politico-military plans for dealing with the eventual crisis. And then Loftus and Ahrens go on to comment about that excerpt from a document. It is clear from this top-secret document that Bush asked for and received authorization to prepare preemptive policy options, unquote. If this sounds strikingly familiar to the preventive action, unquote, program of the Jonathan Institute, it is no coincidence. Bush intended to strike the first blow in the war on terrorism, having learned such strategies from the Israelis. In short, George Bush's job was to coordinate the State Department, CIA, military, and any other government agency in preparation for another terrorist attack or hostage crisis. No one but Bush was responsible for the disasters to come. And I would add that even though he was formally out of office, that would include Waco. The Justice Department under George Bush, by the way, the last attorney general that he had was William Barr himself, a quote ex-unquote CIA officer who formally left the agency at the same time as George Bush when Carter did not reappoint George Bush director of Central Intelligence. And the subordinates in charge of Waco will be the focus of later discussion. Continuing with the Loftus Ahrens text. Of course, as plans for dealing with the terrorists grew more ambitious, Bush's Special Situation Group needed a bigger staff. Bush's aide, Don Gregg, just could not do it all on his own. On May 14, 1982, the White House made another top-secret reorganization. A memo was sent to the Secretaries of State, Treasury, Defense, the Director of the CIA, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They were told that under Vice President Bush's SSG, there would be created a, quote, crisis pre-planning group, unquote, to handle the staff functions. The memo also announced that, quote, the first meeting of the CPPG is scheduled for Thursday, May 20th, 1982, in the White House Situation Room from 1,000 to 1,200. That would be the hours, by the way, in military time, 10 o'clock to noon. Agencies are requested to provide the name of their CPPG representative to Oliver North, NSC staff, and then gives his telephone number, unquote. During a television interview, Oliver North insisted that he had always worked for the NSC and denied having kept Vice President Bush briefed on his work. This was a lie. As the memo just cited shows, at least as early as May 14, 1982, North was already detailed from the NSC to work for Bush's CPPG. As a practical matter, the CPPG's staff work was done by an informal subgroup called the 208 Committee. Reagan had created a secret cell inside the White House, separate from the normal command structure. Reagan was a nice old guy who read his scripts well. When it came to intelligence operations, he trusted Casey and Bush to tell him what to do. They were, after all, both heads of the CIA. If Bush wanted a new spy service, he got it. That did not go over well with the Secretary of State, George Shultz, who wrote a memo in protest on May 25, 1983, complaining that the structure of the Vice President's private intelligence organization was hampering the coordination of U.S. efforts in Central America. Reagan wrote a polite memo back to Shultz informing him that Bush's SSG-CPPG structure would stay the way it was and that Shultz should help make it work. An attached chart showed that Shultz's State Department was below the NSC, which was below the president. To the left of the NSC and above Shultz was Bush's SSG-CPPG apparatus. When it came to terrorism or the Contras, Bush's Special Situations Group had the final say. This last sentence again, because it's basically a thesis statement. When it came to terrorism or the Contras, and as we'll see later, Iraqgate, Bush's Special Situations Group had the final say. To put it bluntly, Bush was running a White House within the White House. Its members could co-opt or circumvent any government agency they wished. There would be no leaks, but unfortunately no independent criticism of their plans either. The Vice President's SSG was the perfect hiding place for some of the bizarre operations dreamed up by Bush, Casey, Robert Bud McFarlane, Dewey Claridge, and North. Our intelligence sources say that these five men are the morons, unquote, who bungled their way into the Iran-Contra affair and then tried to shift the blame to the National Security Council or to Israel, even to Ali North, anywhere but back to the office of the Vice President. By the way, it should be known that there were even many people in the CIA who opposed a lot of the aspects of Iran-Contra. One should not, when looking at the U.S. intelligence community, assume it's a monolith. It's not, as I've stated in the past. Even the CIA is anything but monolithic, and there were many people within CIA who opposed the Bush plans and what Oliver North was doing. However, they were not to prevail. But one should bear in mind that there are many people within the CIA and other organizations who are genuine patriots, a badly abused term these days, and are not out to subvert this country, although there are also outright fascist elements within that and other government agencies who sadly have been allowed ascendancy. And I think much of the responsibility for that lies with the American people themselves and their casual aspect, their casual approach to absolutely vital political matters. Now, more about this private spy service or White House within a White House that George Bush was running, and it was the main vehicle, as we already looked at, for Iran-Contra. We're going to look at that some more in a minute. It also was the major vehicle for George Bush to get involved with the arming of Iraq. We're going to talk about that, too. According to Alan Friedman's book, Spider's Web, oh, by the way, returning to The Secret War Against the Jews by Loftus and Ahrens, according to Alan Friedman's book, Spider's Web, Vice President Bush played a covert role in Casey's Iraq initiative. This was the initiative to arm Iraq against Iran in the Iran-Iraq War. Continuing, like Perry's discussion of Cambodia, Friedman makes a powerful case that Bush was inextricably intertwined with Casey's bizarre initiative to buy Iraqi oil and Hussein's allegiance with guns. There is no doubt that transferring American weapons to Iraq was highly illegal, but was approved by both Bush and Casey. It was also hidden from both the Secretary of State and Congress. Both times Casey and Bush teamed up, the operation involved gun running. It is no coincidence that both secret operations began in 1982, the same year that Vice President Bush established his Special Situations Group for Counterterrorism. What neither Perry, that's Mark Perry, the author of Eclipse, The Last Days of the CIA, nor Friedman realized was that Bush and Casey worked together on a third covert operation, the Arms for Hostages deal with Iran. According to our sources, the story of Bush's role as the secret architect of Irangate has never been told before. It was run just as poorly as the Cambodian gun running and just as illegal as the arming of Iraq, but it was much better hidden from Congress. And people involved with either the Iran-Contra affair or the Iraqgate affair that was the popular name applied to the BNL scandal. The Atlanta branch of the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro, a major Italian commercial bank, was used as one of the major financial vehicles for the arming of Iraq. As discussed in the book Spider's Web by Alan Friedman, there was a lot of popular coverage. Although Oliver North was not the main architect of Iran-Contra, he certainly was involved, but he was a subordinate to George Bush. What we're going to look at now is the role of some of the people who were in these interagency governmental networks, part of this network or White House within a White House that ultimately was controlled by George Bush. In this case, they were reporting to Oliver North. We're going to take a look now at some of the drug-running aspects of the Iran-Contra affair, and specifically at the federal intimidation of a witness named Jack Terrell. Jack Terrell had been informing to John Kerry's subcommittee, a senatorial subcommittee looking into, or a senatorial committee, I should say, looking into the complicity of elements of U.S. intelligence in the narcotics traffic. And Jack Terrell also served as a key informant for the Christic Institute in their ill-fated suit against some of the Iran-Contra principals. We're going to turn to a book called Cocaine Politics, subtitled Drugs, Armies, and the CIA in Central America. That book was co-authored by Peter Dale Scott and Jonathan Marshall, one of the better books about the intelligence community and the narcotics traffic. It was published in softcover by the University of California Press and copyright 1991. The ISBN number for paperback is 0-520-07781-4. And what we're going to look at is the role of Oliver North working underneath George Bush in administering counter-terrorist activities. And bear in mind that the directives, including not only NSDD3 but NSDD138, helped to set up these networks, which had a minimal effect in combating terrorism. They actually promoted terrorism in places like Latin America. They did serve, however, as the main vehicle, as we've looked at, for Iran-Contra and the Iraqgate affair. Turning to Cocaine Politics by Scott and Marshall, we read, the OSG, by the way, is the operations subgroup of the Terrorist Incident Working Group, so it's the OSG-TIWG. Of its creation, we read, the OSG, with concomitant powers conferred on North, had been created by National Security Decision Directive NSDD-207 of January of 1986, as a result of the report of then-Vice President Bush's task force on combating terrorism. It was an operational strengthening of an earlier group, the TIWG, which had been created by a National Security Decision Directive, NSDD-138, drafted by North in April of 1984. The stated purpose of both groups was to centralize the counterterrorism powers of the military and the intelligence agencies to capture international terrorists. OSG-TIWG was authorized to bypass normal communications channels and deal with counterterrorists directly. It was even given its own secure flash communication network to do so. This ability to dispense with red tape was the key to North's operational successes at the NSC, above all when he was able to coordinate the capture of the terrorists who murdered Leon Klinghoffer aboard the Italian liner Achille Lauro. By the way, the Achille Lauro hijacking was engineered to a large extent by Manzer El-Kassar, who was also working directly with Oliver North and the Reagan White House in bringing Contra East Bloc weapons to the Contras. He also was one of the major figures involved in checking American weapons that were going to Iran. He also was credited with the DEA with bringing 20% of the heroin that comes into the United States each year, and has been implicated in a variety of terrorist incidents, including some by some sources, Pan Am Flight 103. Bear in mind here, although the focus on the Scott Marshall text is on Oliver North, that really, as we've already looked at, Oliver North was subordinate to George Bush, who was the capo de tutti capo, so to speak, in Iran-Contra and the Iraqgate affair. Back to the Cocaine Politics text by Peter Dale Scott and Jonathan Marshall. But these stated objectives of OSG-TIWG were not its only ones. From its creation, TIWG was the core of a counter-bureaucracy, separating the administration's hardliners from the CIA's moderates, or in North's terms, the men from the mice. Operations that the CIA moderates opposed, like the Iran arms negotiations with the suspected arms dealer Manuchar Gobanafar, were simply handled by Casey through North and his network of counter-terrorists. Strengthened with powers and personnel from Bush's task force, The OSG-TIWG became the network that North used both to supply the Contras and to negotiate the controversial arms sales to Iran. And the upshot of much of the creation of these networks, again with George Bush at the top, but Oliver North administrating on his behalf, is summed up by Scott and Marshall with regard to the effect this had on the war on drugs. In conclusion, the U.S. government, in the midst of its self-proclaimed war on drugs, was using its own powers of law enforcement and justice to protect known drug traffickers. The successful silencing of Jack Terrell was only part of a larger Reagan administration campaign, lodged chiefly in the Justice Department, to prevent exposure of the Contra drug connection, and more specifically, to prevent the Kerry staff investigation from being taken up by a Senate Foreign Relations subcommittee. And as we're going to see, two of the people that were involved with the silencing of Jack Terrell were a fellow named Mark Richard and another fellow named Oliver Revelle, who was working out of the FBI. Mark Richard was working out of the Justice Department. Of the role of not only then Deputy Assistant Attorney General Mark Richard, but also Oliver Buck Revelle, in pressuring and helping to silence Jack Terrell, who again was informing to the Kerry Committee and also to the Christic Institute about Contra complicity in drug running, something that now has become very well known but was not that well known in the mid-80s. We read, late in 1987, Assistant U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Feldman, F-E-L-D-M-A-N, began to be concerned that the Corvo case was being delayed because of its relevance to Senator Kerry's proposed Contra drug investigation in Washington. Feldman informed the Kerry subcommittee in 1988 that a justice official had told him of an October 14, 1986 meeting in the office of Deputy Assistant Attorney General Mark Richard, note that name, quote, to discuss how Senator Kerry's efforts to get Republican Committee Chairman Senator Richard Lugar to hold hearings in this case could be undermined. This last sentence again. Feldman informed the Kerry subcommittee in 1988 that a justice official had told him of an October 14, 1986 meeting in the office of Deputy Assistant Attorney General Mark Richard, quote, to discuss how Senator Kerry's efforts to get Republican Committee Chairman Senator Richard Lugar to hold hearings in this case could be undermined. The justice official, Thomas Marum, capital M-A-R-U-M, confirmed to the Kerry subcommittee staff that the meeting, quote, was in fact about the continuing Foreign Relations Committee interest in the Posey CMA case, unquote. That, by the way, is what Jack Terrell was informing on. Yet all but one of the six FBI agents at the meeting were from the counterterrorism staff of Oliver Revelle, who had placed Terrell under surveillance. Note that Oliver Buck Revelle, was one of the FBI people in these counterterrorist networks that basically were Bush's own private spy service and a White House within a White House. And note also Mark Richard, a deputy assistant attorney general the time. Mark Richard, by the way, was revealed in Volume 2 of the CIA's internal investigation of the Contra drug traffic to be one of the people involved in the memo of understanding that basically made it okay for the CIA not to report to other government agencies that some of their contacts might be involved in drug running. This basically, as many commentators have noted, indicates prior intent on the part of the Iran-Contra team. We've discussed that in, among other programs, one of our discussions with Mike Rupert, former LAPD narcotics investigator, who has heroically crusaded against the intelligence community's involvement in the narcotics traffic. Do note Oliver Revelle and Mark Richard. According to Daniel Sheehan of the Christic Institute, Mark Richard was one of the Justice Department officials in charge of the Waco investigation. And Oliver Revelle was the chief spokesperson for law enforcement on the scene at Waco. Bear in mind that that siege started on the last weekend in February of 1993, the same weekend that the World Trade Center bombing occurred. Bill Clinton had been in office for roughly a month. I'm not sure if Janet Reno had even been confirmed as Attorney General at that point, or whether she was still an Attorney General designate. Clinton had a couple of his attorneys general designates turned down by the Senate. We're going to be coming back to the networks created by the vice president or pursuant to the vice president's task force on combating terrorism, their role in Iran-Contra, their role in the Iraq-Aid scandal, and their role on site in Waco. Remember the vice president's task force on combating terrorism. Remember its primary role in the Iran-Contra and Iraq-Aid affairs. And bear in mind that Oliver North was a subordinate in these affairs. We're going to be coming back to Waco and how this all ties in the second half of this program. The various tapes that I've done over the years, tapes of many of the lectures that I've done, tapes of the weekly One Step Beyond shows from my home base station, KFJC-FM, in the South San Francisco Bay Area, the all-important archive documentary programs, and the for-the-record half-hour segments are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire webpage at spitfirelist.com. That's one word, SPITFIRELIST.com. The Spitfire website is also equipped with real audio, so you can hear the tapes going out to the various stations that carry this program each week. That is to say, the For the Record segments. There is also a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the KFJC website, which is also equipped with real audio. The KFJC website is at KFJC.org. Actually, it's not equipped with real audio, but it is equipped with internet capability so that people can listen to the program that I do on Sunday nights, 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific time and 6 to 7 p.m. on Thursday night Pacific time on the KFJC website. Like the Spitfire website, it also has a list of and description of the tapes available from Spitfire. It's usually a few weeks behind the Spitfire website. However, very shortly, I am informed by one of our web people here, the various references in the For the Record segments are going to be interconnected so that you can click on one of the many program references. It'll take you right to that reference. There's also a reading list on the KFJC webpage, which is not available on the Spitfire website, although it's a number of years out of date. Again, the Spitfire website, spitfirelist.com. The KFJC website is kfjc.org. I get a small royalty from the sale of the archive shows only. I get no monies from recent, present, or future on-air endeavors. People can also reach me by email at demory@kfjc.org. That's demory@kfjc.org. I'm very busy and don't have time to answer correspondence, not even email most of the time, so don't be insulted if you don't get an answer. I'm simply overburdened at this time. That concludes this half hour. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.